Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents True Crime Philadelphia. From America's first bank robbery to the real-life killers who inspired Boardwalk Empire. By Catherine Canavan. Narrated by Melissa Redmond. Publisher's note. This audiobook contains references to material present in the print and ebook editions of the book. Forward. Things don't always go exactly according to plan for criminals in Philadelphia. More often than not, even celebrated crooks like Al Capone and H.H. Holmes have proved no match for the ordinary citizens of Philadelphia. This book raises a glass to the clever, heroic, and quietly confident everyday Philadelphians who have tripped up criminals for more than 300 years. Curious pipe fitters, nosy neighbors, dogged detectives, bold patrolmen, heroic homemakers, fearless mechanics, take-charge delivery boys, and always sharp-eyed passersby. When bank robber Willie Sutton tunneled out of prison and popped up out of a hole along Fairmount Avenue in broad daylight in 1945, it was an unshakable average citizen who foiled his escape. When Octavius Cato was assassinated on South Street on Election Day 1871, a 61-year-old brickmaker jumped off a trolley car and chased down the 21-year-old shooter. When a former madam fell from a mansion window on Leafy Pine Street in 1868, it was her neighbors who deduced she was killed with a fireplace poker in the sitting room. They pressed the police to arrest her son-in-law on the spot. America's first kidnapping unfolded in Germantown on July 4th weekend, 1874. Stealing a child was so unheard of that police laughed about it. So the boy's father and uncle followed the clues on their own. Within months, the search for little Charlie Ross had spread to three continents. Whenever you walk city streets, you likely pass places where headline-grabbing crimes happened decades or centuries earlier. Historic crimes happened at every turn here, and historically, Philadelphians rarely hesitated to break a few rules or step over some lines to save the day. Single-handedly or in impromptu groups, Philadelphians are problem solvers who quietly take charge when things break badly. The most sensational bank robbery in city history is an extreme example of average Philadelphians stepping up with no thought for themselves. Any savvy bettor would have predicted the professional holdup artists would prevail in the Alleyne Bank and Trust robbery of 1926. They planned the caper for weeks and armed themselves with high-caliber weapons. For a few brief seconds, they were holding a fortune that would be worth almost $1.2 million today. Until the people of Philadelphia put their thumbs on the scale. The robbers didn't count on the extraordinary pluck of the ordinary people of Alleyne. Instead of running from a hail of bullets, men and women ran out onto the street to offer any help they could. Just as the bandits thought they were scot-free, passerbys armed themselves with handguns and rifles and knives and, in one less successful instance, a broom. It turned into a scene rivaling It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. Those who had cars invited police officers and armed strangers to jump in. A woman in a second-story window threw an automatic pistol and an ammo clip to a stranger on the street who shouted, "Does anyone have a gun?" Two men laying a gas pipe decided to join the chase instead. A boy grabbed the satchel of cash and carried it back to the bank. A mechanic, a night watchman, and a poultry salesman, all strangers until that morning, tailed the robbers together. When the mechanic spotted one of the stick-up men on Erie Avenue, in a jaw-dropping move, he jammed a borrowed pistol into the back of the bandit's head and shouted, "Drop that gun or I'll blow your head off." When it comes to crimes, Philadelphians are a resourceful bunch, whether committing them or stopping them. The city's long history provides plenty of examples. The country's first bank robbery came off on Chestnut Street in 1798. The first mass murder happened near present-day Citizens Bank Park in 1866, when axes and hammers were the automatic weapons of the day. the six Lanzetta brothers, the real-life models for the murderous D'Alessio brothers in HBO's Boardwalk Empire, met their ends in stranger-than-fiction fashion on city streets. One's corpse was tied to the running board of a touring car. Notorious Chicago serial killer H.H. Holmes met the hangman on Passion Avenue in one of the most bizarre executions in state history. Holmes's body, encased in 2,000 pounds of cement to deter grave robbers, rests in Holy Cross Cemetery just over the city line in Delaware County. Despite the cement, it was removed from the ground for 117 days in 2017. A chubby-faced tailor masterminded the largest mass murder plot in U.S. history on Passion Avenue in the 1930s. His partners in crime were unhappy homemakers. Their weapons were love potions, hexes, the evil eye, and arsenic sprinkled on spaghetti. When the case broke wide open, the usually quiet corridors of City Hall were filled with fortune tellers, womanizing witch doctors, and a parade of self-made widows in black dresses. Harry Wadlinger just wanted his golf clubs when he bounded up the steps to his house on North Kamak Street on December 7, 1944. He found Susie, his mop-haired terrier, locked in the basement and barking furiously. Then he discovered his wife, Frida, in a dark upstairs bathroom. The room was a fight scene. The attractive brunette was sprawled on the floor in a pool of her own blood. The maid did it. 30-Minute Gertie, a World War II-era housemaid, could strip a new employer's home of valuables in less than half an hour. In the 1950s, Philadelphia's top cop spent 10 years trying to prove a burglary case against Lillian Reese, a city showgirl so sultry she was once arrested for lewdness for doing the twist fully clothed. He contended the brunette beauty masterminded the most lucrative house burglary in Pennsylvania history. His case fizzled when one burglary witness was stabbed to death waiting for a bus, one was blown up on Alma Street, and a third was fished out of the Atlantic with a heavy chain padlocked around his torso. While the Founding Fathers were hammering out the Constitution's guarantees of life and liberty in 1787, just a few blocks away, a crowd stoned a woman believed to be a witch. Catholics and Protestants fought each other with cannons on city streets during the Bible riots of 1844. The line about Max Boo Boo Hoff around Philadelphia was, "Whatever Boo Boo wants, well, that's what Boo Boo gets." The millionaire bootlegger became so famous that Damon Runyon and James Thurber wrote about him. The district attorney, who could never quite nab him, crowned him King of the Bootleggers. 10 of the villains in this book took their last glimpses at the world from atop gallows or buckled into an electric chair. Except for Holmes, whose story was revived in Eric Larson's best-selling The Devil in the White City, they are now part of a forgotten Philadelphia. Although some of these true crime stories stun or startle, this is a work of nonfiction. Every detail and quotation in this book is true and documented in endnotes, which can be found in the print and ebook versions of this book. Lillian Reese's celebrity room is gone from Juniper Street now. The site of the 1866 Axe Octo murder is now a food warehouse. The spot where H.H. Holmes swung from the gallows for 33 minutes is an Acme market now. The pirates who once plied the Schuylkill are gone too. Snatches of the past still exist, though. Al Capone served his first prison term in Philadelphia, and you can visit a reconstructed model of his cell at Eastern State Penitentiary, now a tourist attraction. You can still stroll by the old Sylvania Hotel at 1324 Locust Street, where Boo Boo Hoff had 175 telephones installed in his office in the 1920s. The exterior of Frida Wadlinger's Kamak Street home is largely unchanged. The site of Octavius Cato's assassination at 812 South Street is dotted with a state historical marker. When you drive down narrow Alma Street, you can slip back to the summer of 1961 when Richie Blaney turned his car key and set off an explosion that sent his sedan's heavy hood soaring over the row house roofs. If you are from Philadelphia, your own ancestors might have played a part in committing these crimes or solving them. No matter where you're from, your ancestors likely followed these crime stories because they made headlines coast to coast and sometimes worldwide. Chapter 1. The Lily and Reese Case. The Beauty, the Sugar Daddy, the Tax Cheat, and the Toppled Cop. Lillian Reese was so beautiful that conversation would drop to a low hush whenever she walked into a room. Men described her as a swell-looking dish and a capital G glamour girl. She once got arrested for lewd behavior for doing the twist fully clothed. When Philly's top cop said she was the brains behind a $500,000 heist in a coal town she had never set foot in, he set in motion a string of unintended consequences that would upend dozens of lives, including his own. Mahantongo Street was the swankiest address in Pottsville, Pennsylvania, in 1959. Perched atop one of the coal city's seven hills, the tree-lined stretch was dotted with formal gardens, wrought iron balconies, and Queen Anne porches. It was home to Pottsville society, doctors, lawyers, bankers, and coal barons. Novelist John O'Hara grew up in a six-bedroom Italianate townhouse there. The Yingling Brewery Scion occupied a stately 20-room turn-of-the-century Tudor. Millionaire John Rich raised his family in a three-story stucco built in 1927 on one of the best corners. So why were four mooks from out of town cruising up and down Mahantongo in a yellow Lincoln on the picture-perfect high summer evening of August 7, 1959? And why were they packing a hacksaw, a sledgehammer, and an empty carry-all bag? They came to hunt for negotiable bonds in a stranger's basement. They drove almost 100 miles on an inside tip from Lillian Reese's pot-bellied sugar daddy. Clyde Bing Miller, a one-time college football star at Bucknell, was lovesick over Reese, a curvy chorus girl 25 years his junior. Miller, a paunchy 53-year-old mining engineer, had done business with John Rich of 1801 Mahantongo Street, owner of Gilberton Coal Company. Rich was aptly named. He was so wealthy he owned the largest dragline strip mining shovel in the world, one with a scoop the size of a one-car garage. Miller knew Rich routinely stashed bonds in a safe in his basement because he didn't report all his income to the Internal Revenue Service. Then, by chance, in the first week of August, Miller was admitted to Pottsville Hospital, where he heard chit-chat that Rich was vacationing in Italy and wouldn't be home for another 3 weeks. He immediately thought of Reese, the cigarette-voiced stunner he had already showered with cash and cars and furs and jewels worth more than $150,000. He paid her rent. He paid for her maid. He bought a mink stole for her and one for her sister. He bought her a garbage disposal, a washing machine, and a full-length fur coat. And on August 6th, he walked to the payphone in the hospital lobby with 45 cents to make a long-distance call to her. With that 45-cent call, he set up the most lucrative house burglary in Pennsylvania history. The next day, the four men in the Lincoln drove roller coaster roads deep into anthracite coal country to check whether Miller's tip was solid. Two of the men in the Lincoln also had been romantically involved with Reese. When the Lincoln turned onto Mahantongo Street around 6 p.m., it was still sunny and mild. The occupants didn't know it, but they narrowly missed the caretaker who checked the property daily. The house looked deserted, but their business was best done in the dark. So they headed to a tap room where they ordered beer and sandwiches and waited for the sun to set. By the time they returned sometime after 8 p.m., darkness enveloped Mahantongo Street. They walked around the back of the house near the swimming pool and broke in through the kitchen door. Ralph Staino Jr., Reese's broad-shouldered 27-year-old current flame, walked to a front window to serve as lookout. John Berkery, 30, a handsome oil salesman from New Jersey, headed to the basement to crack the safe with Vincent Blaney, 28, a Philadelphia man with one distinguishing feature, an oversized front tooth. Robert Polson, 24, followed with a carry-all bag for the cash. As Blaney approached the safe, it was a typical Friday night elsewhere in Pottsville, with couples headed out to the pictures. The musical, South Pacific, was playing at the Capitol Theater in CinemaScope and high-fidelity stereophonic sound. The Strand was offering a horror double feature, The Woman-Eater and The H-Man, the latter with the tame tagline, "It's H on Earth." Blaney had the safe open in fewer than 15 minutes. He peeled it, removing the outermost layer and the asbestos lining. Then they broke the handle. In the basement light, it seemed to be stuffed with old newspapers. Then Polson cried, "It's money." They realized they were staring at a large safe jammed tight with U.S. currency. When they recalled it later, they said they could hardly believe their own eyes. Polson and Blaney ran upstairs to Steno with fists full of dollars. The carryall was quickly filled, and someone ran to a bedroom to fetch a pillowcase. Instead, he snatched a large bolster off the bed. In their haste to fill it, they didn't realize the money was falling out on the floor. Bolsters are open on both ends. Upstairs again, they grabbed two pillowcases and started filling them with cash. One was bulging when they heard a siren. Steno shouted, "Here come the cops!" They ran upstairs so fast, they created a traffic jam at the kitchen door. They huddled on the back porch, watching for a prowl car, but it was a false alarm. The siren had sounded the Friday night curfew for teenagers. Too shook to go back downstairs, they piled into the car with the loot, a diamond bracelet, and at least six bottles of Rich's liquor. They couldn't believe their luck. Someone had gone off to Europe and left almost $500,000 unguarded in his basement. At 66, Rich was the second biggest employer in a coal town where everybody knew everybody for generations. He probably never envisioned an after-dark visit from four outsiders. By the time the Lincoln left Mahantongo Street, it was carrying $478,000 and burglars so happy they burst out in song. They belted out an Irish drinking song, except for Steno, who was of Italian descent. He didn't want to sing it, so they sang without him. Blaney had $13,000 in his hands, and he kept counting it. Steno was so excited he couldn't drive, so Burkery took the wheel for the trip back to Philadelphia. They started joking they'd call themselves the Darby O'Gill Gang, based on the name of a new Disney movie. A euphoric Steno realized that one heist with them had made him rich. "To hell with the mafia," he said. "I'm with the Darby O'Gill mob from now on." They had blundered into a payoff that was bigger than their expectations. They were halfway home when someone realized they had left the bonds on the bottom shelf of the safe. They had also dropped an envelope containing 10 $100 bills. They stopped at Steno's West Philadelphia apartment to count the money. They poured it out on the bed. "It damn near covered the whole bed," Polson said. They counted it three times, coming up with a different count each time. They got up to $400,000, but were just too tired to count anymore. Blaney took one share to his brother Richie's place in a brown paper bag. He spilled the cash out on the kitchen table to show him. Then he stashed it in Richie's oven and went out to celebrate. They had made a clean getaway. Or at least it seemed that way on that perfect 70-degree night in the summer in the city. In fewer than 2 years, both Blaney brothers would be dead. That was how the rich caper began. Soon the beauty, the burglars, the safecrackers, and the sugar daddy would be joined by the killers, the mastermind, the tax cheat, the stool pigeon, and the legendary detective who met his undoing. The crime came to light the next day when the caretaker spotted the busted screen door and the open back door. Inside, asbestos footprints covered the kitchen floor. He peered down the basement stairs and saw the mangled safe. Somebody had dropped a necklace on a step. He didn't go downstairs because he feared he'd be a suspect. He called Rich's adult daughter, who called her brother. To the caretaker's surprise, neither of them seemed ruffled. Jack Rich said his father never kept more than $3,000 or $4,000 in the safe. They put in a transatlantic call to their father, but he did not head back to Pottsville. His vacation unspoiled, he spent another 3 weeks in Italy. While the coal baron was touring Italy, Berkery bought a new house with Rich's money. He chose a particular suburban New Jersey property because it resembled Rich's home in Pottsville. He had it painted white, like Rich's. He told friends he wanted to be reminded of the biggest score he ever made. He even had it carpeted wall to wall in blue, because Rich did. He also had Mrs. Rich's diamonds reset in a nice ring for himself. Berkery and his wife Rosalie took a 2-week, $10,000 luxury hotel vacation to California. He spent another $2,000 on a mink stole for her. They bought $8,000 worth of French provincial furniture for their new house. He bought a red and white Edsel for Rosalie, and a gold Lincoln, and a blue and white cabin cruiser for himself. Lavish spenders Polson and Blaney told strippers about their big score upstate. Staino asked a friend if he would change some bills into hundreds for him. When the man agreed, Staino handed him a shirt box with more than $10,000 inside. The heist didn't make the papers in Philadelphia, but Captain Clarence Ferguson, a legendary Philadelphia police detective, heard that some suspects were suddenly spending big, thanks to a heist in the coal country. He called Pottsville police, but they said the take from the Rich robbery was only about $20,000, including the jewelry. Ferguson was stumped for the moment. As head of the much-publicized unit dubbed Fergie's Boys, the swaggering detective had carte blanche to investigate anything he wanted. He wanted to know where these mooks were getting the money. Fergie caught a break when Richie Blaney tired of being jailed on a probation violation. In return for early release, Blaney served up his brother's burglary crew and the $478,000 heist. He had all the details from his brother, Staino, and Berkery. They had even taken him to Pottsville and pointed out the Rich house, hoping he might sign on for a second burglary to steal the forgotten bonds. Blaney told Fergie the largest share of the $500,000 heist went to Lillian Reese, the splashy new owner of the Celebrity Room, who was billed as Tiger Lil. She hosted up-and-comers like Don Rickles and Johnny Mathis at her popular Center City venue. Her arrest would ensure front-page headlines. Fergie set out to prove the $40,000 Reese paid for the Juniper Street Club came from Rich's safe. He could draw a line from Reese to the money, but it wasn't a thick line. By April, 9 months after the heist, Fergie had arrested Reese, Staino, Berkery, Miller, Polson, and Vincent Blaney. Suddenly, news pages were plastered with headshots of husky Staino, handsome Berkery, jowly Richie Blaney, and Fergie in his trademark flat-topped pork pie hat, and full-length shots of leggy Lil, who favored skin-tight knits and stiletto heels. Fergie and Lil were masters of public relations. She wooed reporters to her limbo contests. He took them along on police raids. Their disdain for each other was unmistakable. She scoffed at his claim that she needed to pull a heist to buy her nightclub. "If I really wanted just money, I could go out today and marry one of the many men with money who want to marry me," she said matter-of-factly. Although his bald head and deeply lined face made Fergie appear older than his 63 years, he quipped to a reporter that the shapely 31-year-old Reese had some mileage on her. In the lead-up to the trial, Fergie's boys turned some of the suspects into state's witnesses. Robert Polson stopped talking after he was beaten, stabbed, and shot while waiting for a bus. Vincent Blaney was beaten almost senseless on August 1, 1960, but he kept talking until mid-August, when someone put a bullet in the back of his head, padlocked a weighted chain to his torso, and dumped him in the Atlantic near Margate, New Jersey. They knocked out most of his teeth, but left the oversized one in the front for identification. He was fished out on August 23rd. The Daily News dubbed it a seagoing murder. Richie Blaney became Fergie's star witness by process of elimination. Blaney idolized Ferguson to the point that he started wearing a pork pie hat like Fergie's trademark topper. Ferguson also seemed to take a shine to his chatty witness, who was bright, funny, an attentive husband, and a doting dad to his three young children. He told people he was doing his best to straighten Blaney out, even taking him to church on Good Friday so he could make his Easter duty. Still, Fergie gave an unvarnished answer to a reporter who asked what would likely happen to Blaney after the trial. Someday, when this is all over, he's going to sit in his car, turn on the motor, and that'll be the end of him. Fergie's gruesome hunch came true more quickly than he expected. Neighbors said Richie Blaney routinely looked in the trunk and under the hood of his car to make sure enemies hadn't planted stolen goods there to get him arrested. But for some reason, he skipped it on his 27th birthday on July 27th, 1961. He woke up late that afternoon, read Anatomy of a Murder, ate two eggs, and walked outside in his ironed Bermuda shorts, perfect attire for an 85-degree day with a light breeze. He waved to his three-year-old neighbor, Brenda Konevsky, and slid into his two-tone sedan. When he turned the key, he likely had no idea someone had stowed three sticks of dynamite under the hood. The sticks were thoughtfully packed to force the explosion up instead of out toward the row homes. They performed exactly according to plan, breaking Blaney's left leg and jettisoning all 219 pounds of him into different parts of the back seat. Next door to the Blaneys, retired police detective Ed Burns had fallen asleep waiting for American Bandstand, a popular national dance show broadcast from a studio in West Philadelphia starting at 3 p.m. He was awakened by the sound of his front window shattering. Inside the Blaney home, Richie's 24-year-old wife, Joanne, holding 4-month-old Joseph in her arms, was bending to sit down on the couch when she felt the house tremble. She said she knew instantly because they had received telephone threats. She ran outside screaming, the baby still in her arms. She cried, "They killed him! They killed him!" Pieces of the car lay in the street, and her husband's nude body landed in a twisted heap on the back seat. The papers said he was blown to eternity. Police recovered his belt and one shoe. Daniel Rubenstein dashed outside just in time to watch the hood from Blaney's car fly up over the row house roofs. Firemen used an aerial ladder to retrieve it from the roof of 4945 Alma Street, more than a football field away. One woman was so flabbergasted, she called the fire department and reported that a man exploded. Neighbors poured out of their homes. One found a car part embedded in the front wall of her brick home. Soon, 100 policemen would be on the scene. Detectives allowed a Daily News photographer to shoot a page one picture of Blaney's lifeless arm extended from the door of his mangled car. It showed his wristwatch, which was still ticking. Glass as fine as sugar covered the blacktop street. A phalanx of housewives came out with their brooms to sweep it up. Blaney's demise put Fergie's case in a tailspin. One reporter called him the angriest man in Philadelphia. Despite his loss of the Blaney brothers, the first trials went Fergie's way. Jurors convicted Polson of burglary on March 24th. Burkery and Staino were convicted on May 9th. When the Staino verdict was read, Reese dabbed her heavily made-up eyes with a pink hanky. Reese pulled up to the Pottsville courthouse in a black limousine for the first day of her trial, but she arrived 50 minutes late. The standing room only crowd inside the courtroom fell silent when she entered in a tan summer dress, cinched at the waist, and white spike heels. Reese wore a new outfit every day of her 20-day trial. That got tongues wagging among the female jurors, who were paid $9 a day. She was sometimes spotted shopping in Pottsville stores during the lunch breaks. Reporters described her outfits daily. A white sheath that looked as if it had been sprayed on, and a tight white skirt with a tighter white sweater. Reese professed not to be interested in making news. "I always wanted to be a headliner, not a headline," she quipped. John Lavelle, her lawyer, turned the prosecutor's claim that Reese had masterminded the burglary on its head. He said that Bing Miller, the government's witness, was the brains of the operation. He told the jurors Miller pinned the blame on Reese to get even with her. Miller was fuming that
sample complete. Ready to continue?